Interesting that the subject of journeys should come up during our prayer time, given the topic we've got for today, because we're different, I'm suggesting, from the rest of the world, because we're on a journey of faith. So our scripture reading is this one, very well known passage. By faith Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. So just to revisit quickly our last topic, we talked, didn't we, about the ladder of trust some months ago now, about the different rungs on this ladder, the first one being that trusting means obeying God. In other words, trusting God enough that he knows best and that we will do what he says. But then when we've stepped onto that first rung, the second challenge is to trust that God will provide. Now, for the sake of our topic this morning, we're going to assume, which I think is not an unreasonable thing, that trust and faith are synonymous. They mean the same sort of thing. So when we read that passage and it says, by faith, Abraham, really, it could have said by trust, because Abraham trusted. Okay. I want to picture Abraham, and I'd like your help with this. If you had to paint a word picture of Abraham, what sort of words would you use? Single words, please. That's the challenge.
Man. Learned.
Sorry?
Learned.
Learned? Learned, okay, yeah.
Brave.
Brave, right.
Prosperous.
Prosperous, successful, yeah.
Faithful.
Mm-hmm.
Handsome.
Okay. No way of knowing that, but all right, yeah.
Visionary.
Visionary, okay. Interesting.
Obedient.
Obedient, okay.
Wow.
Okay.
Strong.
Strong, right.
Deep.
Okay. So what interests me is that the picture, the word picture you are painting, is all positive. And it all describes this great patriarch of a man with a long beard, great dignity, great courage, great trust in God. Did he start out like that?
No.
So when we look at the beginning of the story, we find that actually the story begins not so much with Abraham as with his father. The earlier chapter, chapter 11, says, now Terah took his son Abram, his grandson Lot, son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, the wife of his son Abram, and together they set out from Ur of the Chaldees to go to Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there. Just to put this into context in terms of where this is, and when I was researching this, this somewhat surprised me. Remember Noah's three sons? Shem, Ham, Japheth. Okay. Well, Abraham eventually has a son called Isaac. Isaac has two sons called Jacob and Esau. Jacob and Esau began to look for wives to marry when they were 40 years of age. And that's the point in history where Shem died. Yeah? Because Shem lives 500 years. So he's actually contemporary with these guys. But anyway, so let's look at the family background to these guys. Because Ur of the Chaldees, from which they set out, is a very prosperous city. It's down there in the delta of the Euphrates, not far from Babylon, just at the head of the Persian Gulf, probably modern-day Kuwait. It's a very rich culture in terms of its gods and its religions and temples and so on. They had a library there. They had running water and sewers and so on, long before the Romans came along and all that kind of thing. And this is where God is calling them to come out of. So let's have a look at the background to the family, because there are some things that might surprise you. Starting off with Joshua, who says, long ago your ancestors, including Terah, the father of Abraham, and Nahor, lived beyond the Euphrates River and worshipped other gods. In other words, the background this family comes from is one of idolatry. They are not followers of God. Quite how God gets into this picture and starts to begin to speak to them, I'm not sure. But they come from an idolatrous background. Now, it's interesting also that two generations later, remember I said Abraham, then Isaac, then Jacob. Jacob eventually goes and marries two women back home in this place where the family lives. And when he's eventually had enough of his manipulative father-in-law and runs away, you've gone off because you long to return to your father's household, says his father-in-law. But why did you steal my gods? Now, all right, the word is slightly different. They're not necessarily gods in the way you might think of them, but they're images. And it's a very long, even two generations later, it's a long way from the sort of Ten Commandments standard of do not make a graven image. Okay? But this is the background. Now, there are also some interesting traditions. One is that Terah earned his living as a maker of idols. That was his craft. He was an idol maker. And that leads us to a second very interesting tradition, probably fictitious, but I'll tell you the story because it's a good one. Apparently, sometime after Abram began to hear God speaking to him and so on, Terah went out one day, and when he came home, his workshop was in disarray, all the idols smashed all over the place except for one, the biggest one, who was holding a stick. And when he said to Abram, "Oi, what have you done?" Abram said, "Oh, Dad, it was terrible." He said, "The noise, the racket, the idols all started arguing with one another over who was the greatest." And arguing led to more arguing, and arguing led to fighting, and you can see there's only one left. And Terah said, "Don't talk nonsense." He said, "Idols can't argue, they can't speak, they can't do anything, they can't move." And Abram said, "Well, why do we worship them then?" So, I don't know if there's any truth in such a tradition, but it's interesting. So they left Ur of the Chaldees down here, okay? But because this is all desert, the only route they can take to get to Canaan is up and around what's called the Fertile Crescent. And so this town called Haran is sort of on their way. There's also an interesting tradition that Terah may have originally been from there. And so when he passed through that region on his way to Canaan, it felt so good to visit the green grass of home again that he stuck there, as it were. But then years later, the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country, your people and your father's household, to the land I will show you." And here's that great verse. So Abram went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he set out from Haran. Good news. He's finally beginning to step out in faith. Or is he? You see, the interesting thing happens that there was a famine in the land of Canaan, and Abram went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. How much later was this? Well, chapter 16 gives us a timeline. How old was Abram when he left Haran? 75. Now, he leaves Haran, he goes to Canaan, from Canaan he goes to Egypt. From Egypt he eventually returns to Canaan. 10 years later, he marries another wife. When he's 86, his son is born by that other wife. You do the maths, and then you work out how long it would take to walk from there to there, and you realise he didn't even take his foot off the accelerator in Canaan. He just blew straight through. At most, this whole part of the story takes a year, more likely 3 months. Okay? So much for obeying God. He heads for Canaan, realises he doesn't like the weather, and blows straight on through to Egypt because he's heard that they're prosperous down there. Okay? But this makes me think of something, which is, isn't it true that this is always the way in our own lives? Whenever we step out in faith, whenever we take on some new challenge in terms of our walk with God, and we think the result should be that God will now begin to bless us. What actually happens is there's famine in the land. Why? Because we've got an enemy. And every time we step up to the mark, the enemy doubles his efforts to beat us back down again. And that's exactly what happened with Abram. So instead of staying there in the land of Canaan, he blows straight through and he ends up down in Egypt. But worse is to come. Because as he gets to the border, he's just about to flash his passport when he looks across at his wife and says, "Actually, darling, this is going to be a problem." Because he says, "I know what a beautiful woman you are. When the Egyptians see you, they'll say, 'This is his wife, now kill me, but we'll let you live.' Say you're my sister, so that I'll be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you." Now, he wasn't wrong. As soon as they arrived in Egypt, Pharaoh took one look at Sarah and said, "Yeah, I fancy that." And because she wasn't married to anyone, apparently, he took her into his harem. And the bad news for poor Sarah is that he didn't just keep her as an ornament. Both tradition and there's a clue in the Bible meant that he married her, shall we say. It's interesting also to notice he had no more luck getting her pregnant than her husband had. I'll explain some more about why we say that as we go on. But then God intervenes. He sends a plague on Pharaoh's household, and Pharaoh somehow divines the fact that this must be because of this woman he's taken, and he ends up expelling Abram from the land along with his family, and so he has to go back to Canaan where this famine is. And it's interesting to note, isn't it, that in this respect, a pagan ruler shows a greater sense of morality than Abram does. Because he's disgusted by the fact that he's inadvertently taken someone else's wife. Talk about this journey. Yeah? He didn't use any words to describe that kind of man when we did a word picture of Abram. Now, I want to make a couple of points about this. You see, God's standard for marriage is this. When a man leaves his father and mother and unites with his wife, they become one flesh. Can you split that apart if you worry about what Pharaoh might do to you? No. So this is God's standard. How close to that is Abram? Nowhere near.
No.
And so you wonder about this, and you think, if Abram's not ready yet to be a godly husband, is he ready yet to be a godly father? No. I've always felt it's a little bit unfair of God, because God sort of incentivizes Abram to come out of Haran by saying, I'll give you a son, I'll turn you into a great nation. And then for 25 years plus, nothing happens. God doesn't fulfill his promise. But when you start to really think about it, the realization dawns that God would love to give Abram a son, the special son, the son who will be the father of the nation, but he can't because Abram's not ready. And I wonder whether that's sometimes true in our lives as well. We pray for something, there's something we desperately want, we can't see why God won't let us have this thing, find this thing, give us this thing, and God is saying, I would love to, but you're not ready. You're not ready for what I want to give you, for what I want to do in your life. And of course, when you are, then that will be fulfilled. While Abram is in Egypt, something interesting happens, because while he is pimping out his wife to Pharaoh pays him handsomely, and Abram gets all sorts of sheep and cattle, male and female donkeys, male and female servants. Notice the sequence there, it's quite interesting. And the next chapter tells us that Abram became very wealthy in livestock, in silver and gold. And there's a cautionary tale in this for us, I think, because in the Old Testament there's very much a sort of three-part equation, which is when you obey God and live a godly lifestyle, God blesses you. Blessing equals prosperity. And we take that and we run the equation backwards. And we look at people who are prosperous and we say, aha, they're prosperous because God blessed them. And God blesses them because they must be good people. Well, there is nothing godly about the way Abram behaves, and yet he gets rich off it. And so we've got to be careful not to do that. But there's also a very strange symmetry about this story. You see, as I said, 10 years later, Sarah goes to Abram and she says, look, we're not having children. The Lord has kept me from having children, she says. Go sleep with my slave girl. Who was the slave girl?
Hagar.
Hagar. Who was Hagar? She was an Egyptian. In fact, there's some suggestion that she was a princess. She was one of Pharaoh's many, many daughters, from one of his many, many wives. Okay. Do you notice the symmetry? First of all, because Abram doesn't trust God, Sarah ends up sleeping with an Egyptian. And now, because Abram still doesn't trust God, Abram ends up sleeping with an Egyptian. Do you think either of those were meant to produce the child of promise? But there's this weird symmetry to the thing as we go on. Alright, this is not meant to be the entirety of Abram's story, because if it was, we'd be here till 3 o'clock. But we will come back to some of these things later on. Later on, Abram goes off to battle and rescues Lot from a raiding party. Then God renews a covenant with Abram, We're going to look at this in a future message, because it's very, very significant the way that happens. And then, the one that makes everyone sit uncomfortably is God says, well, if you want to be part of the covenant, you have to be circumcised. Ouch. And then comes the bit where Abram entertains three visitors, one of whom is probably God himself. And we get the whole thing about pleading for Sodom and will you destroy a city if there are righteous people in it and so on. Okay, time passes, and guess what? There's another famine. Apparently, this land of promise isn't quite so promising all the time. And so Abram decides to head south again. He doesn't get quite as far as Egypt this time. He gets as far as Philistine territory. Ends up in a town called Gerar. And guess what? He does exactly the same thing again. He looks at his wife and he says, my goodness me, you're still quite a looker. I'm terribly worried that the people of this place are going to kill me to get to you. Tell them you're my sister, as if he's learned nothing from his previous experience. And he does exactly the same thing again. And he's not wrong, because no sooner do they arrive than the king Abimelech says, ooh, nice looking woman, I like her. And she ends up in his harem. This time he doesn't touch her, which is good, because God actually talks to this pagan king in a dream and says, you're as good as dead because of the woman you've taken. She's a married woman. And once again, Abimelech is horrified by it. And you know, he doesn't want anything to do with this woman. But this time he doesn't actually kick Abraham out of the land. He allows him to live there until the famine is presumably passed. Now, of course, Abram's story doesn't end there, and we will glance back at another point in a minute. But first of all, I want to show you a similarity and a difference when another person ends up in almost identical circumstances. I want to use this to compare and contrast. And I'm talking, of course, about Isaac. So a generation later, 40, 50 years later, Isaac is living in the same country. And guess what? There's a famine in the land besides the previous famine in Abram's time. And Isaac went where? South. Okay. Now, in all fairness to him, he was headed for Egypt, but God told him not to. So he goes down to Philistine territory and ends up in Gerar, exactly the same place Abram did. And guess what? When the people of the place said, oh, who's this beautiful woman with you? He says, she's my sister. Okay? He falls into exactly the same fault as did his father. And again, one day we see Abimelech looking out the window. Here he is, hidden up there, looking out the window, and he sees Rebecca and Isaac being rather intimate. And again, we get this sense of disgust from a pagan ruler saying, well, what if one of us had touched her? It's horrible. Oh, you know, terrible. We couldn't touch another man's wife. But Isaac himself doesn't see any problem with it. So there are similarities between Isaac and the way his father acts. But now let me show you the differences, because the differences are the important bit. First of all, when Isaac was on his way down to Egypt to escape the famine, God appeared to him and said, do not go down to Egypt, live in the land where I tell you to live. Stay in this land for a while, and I'll be with you and bless you. Now, was that any different to the instruction God had given to his father? Not really. He said, go, you know, leave this place, go and live in that place. And Abram said, no thanks, I'll head for Egypt. But the difference is that Isaac chose to stay in the land where God had told him to stay. So that, first of all, is a significant difference between the two men's reaction to the same situation. But the differences become even more powerful when we consider what Isaac did while he was there. Because he didn't just stay. He also planted a crop in that land. And that same year, reaped a hundredfold because the Lord blessed him. Now, I want to just emphasize that for a minute. I was curious about this, and as is my wont, I went and found out about it. And I went and talked to a farmer, and we pulled out some of last year's wheat, and I counted the number of seeds per seed head. And after generations of hybridization and genetic modification, I'm sorry, we're not allowed to do that, but whatever. Do you know how many seeds are produced on each head of wheat? 48. Okay? So if you planted X amount of wheat, you would theoretically get 48 times that amount back. That's assuming that no areas of your field fail to produce a crop. How much does Isaac get back in a year of famine? 100-fold. Is that a miracle? Does God provide? Okay. So these differences are significant. And it ends up with something very, very interesting, because in the end, Isaac becomes so powerful, has such a large household, that the king has to go to Isaac and say, you know, would you mind terribly moving off and menacing someone else, because you're upsetting the local balance of power, because you've got a bigger army than we have, basically. Okay? I want to put that in the context of this ladder of faith or trust we talked about. Did Isaac obey God? Yeah. He stayed in the land. Okay? Did God provide for him?
Yes.
Bountifully. And the interesting question is, where would Abram stand on this ladder at the points we've looked at so far? Not so well. Not so well. Didn't obey God, didn't stay in the land where he was told to go, didn't trust God to provide, which is why he lied about who his wife was, twice. Now Isaac then is a bit better. He still makes that mistake about his wife. He still messes up. He still succumbs to the temptation of fear. He's still a bit of a coward at heart. But he obeys God and he trusts God enough to act on that trust. Now of course for Abraham, the story does not end there. And it would be unfair to move on without thinking about the other end of the story, the other end of the journey. Because I want you to notice those two things we've just looked at, obedience and provision. And I want you to look at the way Abraham's story turns out. God says, take your son, your only son whom you love, this is the child of promise, Isaac, go to the region of Moriah and sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on the mountain I'll give you. And what did Abraham do? He obeyed. So we're up onto the first rung of the ladder. But notice the words he uses now. Because as they're going towards the mountain, he hasn't told his son what's going to happen. Isaac says, well, we've got the fire and we've got the wood, but where's the animal for the sacrifice? And I want you to look at what his answer is. God will provide. The second rung on the ladder. Yeah? Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
So the interesting thing that we need to think about our own lives and start to apply this, we've already said that trusting means that we will obey. Trusting means accepting that God will provide. Asking the question about where would Abraham stand on this ladder? Well, at the start of his journey, nowhere near it. But that's the point. God doesn't take Abraham at the start of his journey and say, oh, you're no good. He takes Abraham on to the close of his journey where, as we've seen, the story is completely different. Isaac fares rather better, having learned at least something good from his father's example. But here's the question, what about us? Where would we stand on that ladder? You see, we're all on a journey. Nice message to give at the start of a new year. We're all on a journey. Even when we're doing what God wants us to do, we still make mistakes. We still fall down. But having faith means that we obey. Our default position is to obey. If God says go here, we go there. If God says stay here, we stay here. Even when, you know, think about those people in that land where there's a famine. Your logic is telling you, get out of here. Your friends and neighbours are all moving out of here, so you've got examples. In Isaac's case, he even had his father's example to go by. What do we do when there's a famine? Head for Egypt. Okay? But God said, stay. That's the kind of obedience we're talking about. And then when we obey, it means we wait for God's provision. But most of all, walking in faith means learning. We're not the finished article. We're on a journey. We're progressing. It's always tempting for Christians to look at one another and say, well, you're not doing this or you're not doing that. But sometimes I wonder if perhaps our worst trait is that we look at ourselves and say, you're not good enough because, and boy, doesn't the devil get you with that one. You're not good enough because. You can't speak to that person about Jesus because. You can't call yourself a follower of God because. But we're on a journey. And we'll make some horrible mistakes along the way. Just like Abram and Isaac both denied their own wives, their own flesh as it were. But they ended up as people who were written up in that chapter on faith. By faith, Abraham. Hebrews chapter 11. In the hall of the giants of faith is a man who failed miserably at the start of his journey. But he didn't end there. My prayer is that we won't either.